Hello and welcome to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24 with me, Auguste Macellari, and Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
On today's show, we'll be meeting artist Ian Chang and curator Hans-Ulrich Obrist to learn more about a new exhibition that probes the boundaries of technology.
Then we'll be reconnecting with nature as we catch up with author Alice Vincent to learn more about her new book, Rootbound.
And we'll be heading to London's Barbican Centre for a look at a new exhibition that explores the changing ways we look at masculinity.
That's all coming up, plus Monocle's Chiara Rimella will be looking ahead to next week's news. It's right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Faye, this is a rare treat.
Love it. So I'm not doing the news look ahead, even though we have a surprise a bit later, I guess.
We might have just given it away in the menu there. Yes, looking forward to the news look ahead. I think it's going to be a good one today. But this week, what have we done?
Well, first of all, the Austrian issue is out now. I mean, you know what? I think I have a close relationship with Austria. I had, for some reason, I have quite a lot of friends there. And, you know, I do like schnitzel. And I do like their soft drink, Almdudler, as well. Have you tried? Have you ever tried that?
Yes, I have tried Almdudler. Delicious stuff.
I love it. I absolutely love it. And, you know, they have a good music scene. I interviewed the DJ Wolfram for the magazine. You know what, Og? This is one of those assignments that was like, well, maybe I'm exaggerating, dream come true. But, well, almost in a way. Because I've been a fan since 2006. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to chat with the man, and he's a very friendly guy.
I had a pretty blissed out time in Austria as well, reporting a story for the magazine. I went up to the dreamy ski resort of Lech. It's quite an upmarket spot, Faye. The hotel that I was profiling, Almhof Schneider, has been a hotel for almost 100 years, was converted from a dairy farm before that. The family that owns it has lived in the town since the mid-15th century, if you can believe that.
That's amazing. Were they friendly and chatty?
Oh, they couldn't have been nicer.
Oh.
We also went on a little excursion, didn't we?
Well, we did. I mean, I don't think we can say much about it.
We can't say much.
But perhaps people should listen to the weekly next week, where I spoke to Jason Blum, from the producer of The Invisible Man and many other great horror films, I have to say, including Get Out.
He's like a horror, a kind of capo, isn't he? Like a boss.
And it's funny, he was not even a big fan of horror when he was younger. So it's quite interesting that he decided to launch Blumhouse Productions.
I think maybe we should move on. You mentioned a kind of bonus news look ahead this week. Should we see who is there on the other side of the glass waiting to come in? It's Chiara Rimella. Welcome. Thank you for joining us.
It is my absolute pleasure, especially to what I must say is a classic of Italian musical composition and one of the fondest memories of my childhood.
It's a good one that I can imagine you had some wild times with that song in the background.
In the back of the car, very, very innocently, I've got to say. I was a child at this time. It was my parents' car, riding at the back, just driving down the motorways in Italy on the way to summer holidays. It just brings me back. So there will be sun at the end of this news look ahead, I promise. We'll get to a very upbeat note. But first up, it's election day in Slovakia. Now, not that that necessarily needs to mean that it's particularly, you know, unhappy times, but it is a bit of a tricky situation in Slovakia at the moment. It's quite a determining election because, sadly, the far-right party is doing extremely well, so well that it's likely to get second spot in terms of how well it's going to poll, and it might even inch itself into another coalition. And it's, you know, it's actually a very, very interesting election because the ruling Social Democrat Party, which is the Smer SD, is currently polling at about 17%. And the far right Popular Party of Slovakia is polling at about 13%. So just four points percentage behind the first party in the country.
Very fractured as well for the first party to have 17%.
I mean, yeah, absolutely. Which is what's really interesting about this election, that so many different parties are going to probably be polling at about 10%. And so there are so many possible outcomes, a broad coalition or perhaps a coalition of the currently ruling party and the far right party. But hopefully the result of the elections will will guarantee a coalition that keeps the far-right party out. Let's put it this way.
I'm sure we'll be hearing more about that from our Eastern European specialist, Guy Delaunay. Chiara, where are we off to next?
Well, do you want to do another tiny little bit of election? Obviously, same day on the fateful Saturday 29th. South Carolina primaries, big day in the US as well. It's going to be a big test for Biden, whether he can bring it back and kind of have a little bit more backing going into Super Tuesday, a little bit, you know, strong in his position. And we will see if it'll deliver.
And it's a bigger and much more diverse state than Iowa and New Hampshire. So I think people will definitely be paying attention for that one.
Yeah, and exactly. This is the first time that there is a considerable proportion of the voting electorate that is African American. And therefore, it's a bit more of an interesting test in terms of demographics and how wider demographics might align later on.
Where next, Chiara?
Well, let's head all the way to Tokyo.
Some fun. Is there a positive story or not?
No, me, I'm a serious girl. You know
me. Of course,
me.
This is hard news.
I'm a hard girl. No, Tokyo Marathon was going to be run by 38,000 people. Is going to be run by 200 elite athletes because coronavirus, guys. But I would like to open this up to you and ask you if you've ever considered running a marathon.
Well, I can start saying no, and I'm not a big fan of marathons, I have to say. I do admire, you know, people's stamina, but yeah, it would take a while for me. What about you, Og?
I've definitely thought about it, but to me it's up there with climbing Everest as a realistic enterprise, undertaking, I should say. It occurred to me when you told us that there's probably 37,800 very... very relieved people out there who are able.
Pissed off, actually, because a lot of people didn't get their entrance fee for the race refunded.
They've been
because
stiffed.
Apparently, yeah, exactly, because it only is refunded in case of a natural calamity. Which you, I guess, in a way, you could say that you know, the obviously awful spread of the disease has been, but I guess it doesn't qualify, so they've been left a little bit shortchanged.
You promised us a little ray of sunlight.
Oh, yes, of course. It's Mardi Gras. So obviously, Faye will know that Carnival is a huge deal in Sao Paulo and in Italy as well. You know, Venice,
yeah,
we have our own version. Obviously, perhaps a little less samba-filled, a bit more somber with our masks. It's quite mysterious in Venice.
Elegant.
Yeah, elegant. I like how you put it. Yeah, elegant. Mardi Gras in New Orleans is a very, very riotous occasion. And I guess it all comes to its very rambunctious conclusion on the Tuesday itself, on the 25th. But actually, and I didn't know this, the celebrations for Mardi Gras in New Orleans go on for such a long time. The first kind of celebration is on January the 6th.
Wow.
And then it's all parade after parade and party after party.
I have to say, I would absolutely love to go to Mardi Gras in New Orleans, especially when I think that here in Grim Grizzly, the United Kingdom,
yeah,
all we have is Pancake Day. That's the best that that's the best it gets this time of year. A flabby, stodgy pancake with lemon and sugar. Talk about austerity. Chiara, thank you so much for joining us. That was a fantastic news look ahead, and it was a ray of sunshine at the end. You at home are listening to the Monocle Weekly. In just a moment, we'll be hearing from artist Ian Cheng and curator Hans Ulrich Obrist about their work on a new exhibition in Madrid.
Artist Ian Cheng uses cutting-edge digital technology to explore exciting new frontiers in visual communication, asking questions about the nature of reality and what we can know about the world around us. Through a process he calls worldling, he constructs elaborate digital simulations peopled with interacting characters. Attempts to enact any sort of narrative are constantly confounded and subverted. His agents react to obstacles and challenges that appear in their way so that an almost infinite vista of possibility of different storylines is opened up.
Ian's work is the subject of a new exhibition organized by Fundación Sandretto Rerebaudengo in Madrid. It's curated by the Serpentine's artistic director, Hans Ulrich Obrist. I sat down with both Hans Ulrich and Ian to learn more about the exhibition, worlding, and what the infinite possibilities of Ian's work spell for the future. Hans Ulrich began by explaining how he first came to work with Ian.
We met with Ian many years ago when Ian worked on the publishing project with Paul Chan, very much at the beginning, really, of Ian's trajectory. And I was from the very beginning extremely fascinated by the work and by this idea of really living simulations Ian was working on, and this whole idea that it is a liberation from the loop, because it's a work with images which no longer, because of course moving images in history have always been caught up in a loop. They would, at a certain moment, it would restart. And this idea that actually Ian would develop these living systems has been from the very beginning a great fascination for me ever since we met. And then we continued the dialogue ever since. And of course it led to an exhibition we did at the Serpentine Gallery, which was about Bob. And we're going to talk about that tomorrow, I suppose.
Ian, this isn't the first time, as Hans Ulrich says, that you've worked together. You work with these living systems. And I wonder, if we zoom out, how across these projects, the collaboration, the exhibiting with one another, how that has turned into a kind of living system of its own.
Yeah, I mean, the way I approach my work with the simulations is that, you know, they are a kind of video game that plays themselves, and the way of making them has always been in updates and iterations. And I felt very much that in working with Hans Ulrich and across different exhibitions, especially Emissaries, that the project itself is in a way updating. So when we first showed it at the Foundation Sandretto in Turin, that was the very first Emissaries. It was also the very first version of the first Emissaries. And as I continued to almost garden this living virtual ecosystem and kind of adjust the behaviors and continue to add new characters and behaviors into that same ecosystem, the version that you'll see in Madrid is in a way secretly a much more advanced version. So I've seen exhibitions almost as chapter markers in a series of updates. And I think that's quite different from the way we normally think and produce art, which is always with a sense of finality when it shows.
I think also the idea of, and I mean, we always say, you know, ESWFSRR, everything started with the Fondazione Sandretto Rebaudengo, because as Ian said, that was really the first time we worked on a bigger exhibition together. And it was amazing to see these computer simulations there, because they relate to a continual change and, of course, also understand the nuances of human consciousness. And this idea, you know, that an artwork in that sense can be so directly related to consciousness. I was always very fascinated already when we worked on this show with Ian in Torino, also by the drawings, because I always had imagined, you know, a digital artist who works with simulation and with AI to actually develop his or her or their work on the computer. And I was always very fascinated that actually wasn't the case. Ian makes extraordinary doodles and drawings and sketches and really invents these worlds. It's an invention of world. It's a making of worlds. And of course, these drawings then lead to these ecosystems. These are digital or virtual ecosystems, and they don't have a limited duration. They can go from order to chaos and then again back to order. It can go in different directions, and they are populated by avatars. And these avatars actually are programmed with artificial intelligence. So it's also interesting that it's one of the very early moments where AI enters the art world. And it's interesting, you know, I grew up in Switzerland, and of course, Paul Klee was one of the first artists I knew. And Paul Klee famously said in the earlier part of the 20th century that art makes the invisible visible. And of course, today we are surrounded by so many invisible algorithms and every day hear about AI, but it's again invisible. So I think, again, you know, artists make the invisible visible, which is why it's so fascinating that Ian also works with AI.
Ian, perhaps before we kind of continue too far into AI, you might explain or describe a bit about this character, Bob, who will be appearing in the show.
Oh, in this upcoming show, it's actually a show of Emissaries, which is the project I did prior to Bob. And it's a trilogy of simulations that take place in a vast ecosystem that across the trilogy and changes over many thousands of years. But in each episode of the trilogy, or in each simulation of the trilogy, the first one shows a community of ancient people who live on the side of a volcano, and the volcano is potentially eruptive, and they have to decide whether to stay or go. And the Emissary character is put into conflict with all the other people in the community. And the way the people in the community are programmed is with a very reactive form of artificial intelligence. And they want to constantly react to what's going on in the environment. Meanwhile, the Emissary character is quite scripted and has a sense of narrative causality and has a plan. And so the way you could say the character with the plan is wrestling with all these characters who are kind of reacting all the time to what's in the moment. And sometimes the emissary character gets wrapped up in these kind of improvisatory plans by everyone else. And sometimes the other characters get wrapped up in the very deterministic plan, the script or the story that the emissary character has. And so I wanted to create a series of simulations that really felt like the sculpting between these two forces of a deterministic story and an open-ended simulation embodied in these reactive community characters.
Hans Ulrich, there you spoke a bit about the idea of making the invisible visible. I recently spoke to William Gibson, who coined the term cyberpunk, and he sort of spoke about science fiction, describing it not as a look into the future, but rather a kind of close examination of the present. I wonder, by using these kind of visualizations through artists like Ian's work and practice, what we do start to learn about ourselves in the moment, in the present day, as mediated by technology.
We called it once with Douglas Copeland and Shimon Bazar the extreme present. The fascinating thing, and I think that's definitely what will be seen in Madrid and what can also be seen in the book, because of course it's not only an exhibition, it's also a book which the Serpentine produced together with the Rebardengo Foundation, which is a book about this emissary trilogy. And it's very telling that Ian wanted to call the book Emissary's Guide to Worlding, Worlding like in World. And it's in that sense really connected about navigation. It's about how to navigate the world, but also how to navigate the unnatural art of creating an infinite game by choosing a present, in answer to your question, by storytelling its past and by simulating its futures and nurturing its changes. So all of that, in a way, at the same time. Now, Ian, and that's actually interesting, when Ian and I met, and as I said, it was at the very beginning of Ian's trajectory before Ian had many exhibitions, it was already all there. And that's the thing which I found so fascinating. The idea of worlding was already there. The idea of worlding as a very active term that refers actually to the imagining of alternative futures or alternative worlds. A strategy which Ian really had from the very beginning, when he had this epiphany actually of making simulations. And in his own world, worlding is the unnatural art of creating an infinite game. And I really think that that's what is so wonderful, is that both the exhibition and the book are this gateway into this infinite game, into this infinite world. It's also a journey, because the emissaries are a journey. There is never repetition. It's never twice the same. And I think that opens up a whole new dimension for moving image in public space. Because, of course, it's very rare that we have a film or a moving image installed in public space as a permanent work because of the loop, because at a certain moment people would want new content, because it would repeat. And I think here it's actually, in the future, I think going to be very interesting to have work like Ian's in the public space. Because imagine, like, you have an emissary's installation or a Bob installation in a subway station, you have it in a railway station, or you have it in a bus, and then every day when you go to work or when you use public transport, you would experience it new. Or then you might be away, you might be on holidays, and then you come back after 3 weeks, after 2 weeks, after a week, and then the story has evolved. So I think it opens up so many possibilities of how to insert moving image into public space, into our lives.
Ian, I recently read an argument suggesting that, you know, this idea of narrative, which has become something of a trendy buzzword, you know, politicians talk about recapturing the narrative. We hear it in various different spheres and sectors. Obviously, narrative is useful in that it allows us to give form and order to situations that maybe are a bit chaotic, but it can also kind of set us up with false ideas about people's motivation, with fake insights. And I wondered how that kind of idea, it sounds like you have this situation where there perhaps is a narrative, there's an agent who's trying to behave according to a narrative, but whose journey through this world is derailed and subverted. And I wondered how you see that in the digital world and the real world, how you see those two things.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, firstly, I would say that from both ancient times and also from the position of when we were children, we're creatures of narrative. In a way, a narrative or story as a structure is the map of how you make sense of your life. It's the map of how you make sense of what you're going to do in the next 5 minutes. And it's definitely the map of how you make sense of speculative, imaginative worlds. And while there's obviously a danger of things like fake news and this sort of thing right now, I think what's really happening right now is that people are becoming more and more exercised and stronger and more fluent with stories and narrative. And I think that can only be a good thing, because it's honestly, right now, story a narrative is our best cognitive technology for making sense of something we don't yet understand, but we're kind of feeling our way through it. The way that a dream is sort of always unfolding like a story, and it's your mind basically trying to make sense of what is still unfolding. And then it's also, for me, very interesting as an artist to think about, in a way, what story am I a part of? All our stories are kind of uniting and colliding right now, like in this radio interview. And we can choose after this interview, to what degree are we each a part of our story? How much did this interaction matter? Did it matter a lot to one of us? Did it matter none to someone else? Did it matter to all of us in different ways or equal ways? You can see a person's life or a person's experience as this kind of time tunnel of a story. And I like this idea also that allows us to think in terms of both the smallest story that we're a part of, which is, you know, I'm going to get a coffee next. And then also this idea of the largest story we're a part of, which is quite an interesting question. Like, is the story we're a part of contemporary art? Is that story not big enough in terms of grandness, but is that actually the wrong lens? Is the story that we're part of like an anthropocentric story? I think the lens of story is quite useful and shouldn't be demoted or rejected because of things like fake news right now.
Hans Ulrich, you mentioned that Ian's work is not just beautiful in its realization, but in preparation as well, that he has this really lovely body of sketches that underpin the worlding that forms his practice. How successful can artworks like this be without this strong visual component? How do they transcend being experiments in new technology?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting your question that you ask about experiments in technology, because, of course, that links us to Billy Kluver, you know, who in the 60s did EAT, the experiments in art and technology. And I went to see the other day Lillian Schwarz, who is in her 90s now and, you know, would have actually studio next to the engineers in Bell Laboratories, leading tech company of the late 1960s, and would work for many years there. And Billy Kluver and his EAT would make projects possible also for Rauschenberg and for Stella and many others, which otherwise they could never have done. Now, today we have the new experiments in art and technology, which is also why at the Serpentine we felt it's important that there is the role of a chief technology officer, which usually museums don't have. So with Ben Vickers, we have a chief, you know, technology officer at the Serpentine, who is, of course, instrumental in making such projects like Ian's happen. And I think they are very visual. I think what is important is that these experiments transform into new displays, into new exhibitions. And I mean, we began really with Ian with a digital commission originally called Bad Corgi, and it can still be downloaded from the website of the Serpentine. It's basically a disobedient corgi. It's very funny. But then, as we discussed, you know, already with the Rebaudengo exhibition, we really started to work on bigger exhibitions together. And I think Ian has always been very interested in display. He's been very interested in how actually it's not just a one single screen experience, but it's a form of architecture. I remember in Torino, Ian built the whole kind of architecture actually for the early emissaries to be visible. And we can see, of course, that this leads to real experiences of visitors. I mean, some people spend up to 3, 4, 5 hours in the exhibition. And that's very rare because, I mean, on average, people spend only 10, 20 seconds, I think, in the museum. There are different statistics, but it's usually in the seconds in front of an artwork. And I think this idea of actually binding visitors is super fascinating. And that is also the case with Bob, Bag of Beliefs, with the AI work of Ian, which is the first work we've had in an exhibition with a central nervous system. And if we look at the visitor book, the guest book of the exhibition, it's quite extraordinary to read the comments because people make really new experiences with that work. For example, somebody wrote into the guest book that they came all the way from Birmingham and they were really deeply disappointed because Bob ignored them. And somebody else wrote into guest book that somebody from London, that they came back to the exhibition 7 or 8 times because Bob was so nice to them. And I think that's certainly a very different experience than what would happen in front of a video or a painting or a sculpture. So it is clearly an experience, and it must be an experience because it must be in an exhibition different from what one could experience at home in front of a screen.
How do those responses, Ian, feed back into your practice? How do they kind of inform your worlding?
Oh man, it makes me immune to hate. Like, by that I mean, like, getting such polarizing responses for me is a sign, I think, that I'm doing my job right in terms of making it work. I think of the simulations in Bob as work that has its own nervous system and that has a sense of its own aliveness. And as we know, when we start to think and deal with alive things like pets, I just had a baby, they're constantly both surprising, constantly predictable. And it is in that margin of their predictable behavior surprising you and knowing that you're going to be in for more surprises later on that keeps you coming back in this very visceral way. And I would hope to have achieved that with Emissaries and especially with Bob. In terms of working forward from that, it just makes me want to double down on making work that is and feels alive.
My thanks to Ian Chen and Hans Ulrich Obrist, and Ian's exhibition Emissaries, organized by Fundación Sandretto Re Rebaudengo, is at Fundación Fernando de Castro, Madrid, from the 25th of February to the 21st of March 2020. If you want to find out more, head to www.fsrr.org. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Og, it's time for some music now. Last week we said goodbye to the great DJ Andrew Weatherall. Let's revisit one of the tunes through which his brilliance first shone. Here is his mix of Primal Screen's Loaded.
That was Loaded, the Andy Weatherall mix by Primal Scream. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24.
Regular listeners will be familiar with journalist and writer Alice Vincent. She's cropped up a number of times on Monocle and Culture, but today we'll be hearing from her in a different capacity as she discusses her new book.
A long-time gardening enthusiast, Alice has used her passion as a lens. It's a jumping-off point for her memoir, Rootbound, Rewilding a Life. A compelling blend of reflections on the natural world, its processes, and the processes of life and love, the book challenges us to question our relationship with nature and explores the similarities and differences between the town and the country. I caught up with Alice to learn more.
I didn't really set out to write a nature memoir or even put as much of my own story into the book as emerged, but essentially, as the book explores, I was in my mid-20s when the kind of things that I had been societally, like many of us, encouraged to want and to achieve, I had been fortunate enough to achieve. And I realised that I just wasn't getting any satisfaction, whether that was from the nice flat I was fortunate enough to live in, or my job, or even the structures of how my social life worked. It all just felt like I was doing what I was meant to, and none of it really scratched that itch. And at the same time, I started to kind of accidentally fall into growing things and gardening. And I wouldn't even call it gardening in the form it was in the beginning. It was literally throw some plug plants in a pot and see what happens. And I found this gave me a kind of meditation and a calm and a satisfaction, frankly, that I literally was unable to find in any of the fancy mini breaks or expensive Japanese homeware or whatever it was that we were supposedly meant to want.
It's funny that, isn't it? There's definitely a generational dissatisfaction that maybe is amplified by social media and by performed successes. And it seems to come hand in hand with this other thing that I think we've thought about here at Monocle, which is this idea that a hobby isn't a hobby or an interest isn't an interest. It's kind of necessarily a side hustle. It's something that ultimately the goal is to take it from the margins, from your leisure time, and make it into what you do.
Yeah.
But I wonder if that engagement with it also ultimately ends up in the same place of dissatisfaction when something becomes work.
It's a really interesting point you raise this, because I originally gardened quietly and just for myself. And then I think maybe because I had a background as a journalist and I worked for a newspaper, I ended up documenting it through a newspaper column and through Instagram. And now that has become what people would describe and see as a side hustle. And it's an interesting thing, like how do you balance what happens when the thing that you go to for quiet release becomes another thing that you're doing to survive upon. For what it's worth, the vast majority of my kind of meditative gardening never really ends up on the internet or ends up documented. That shows the impact it has more than the impact it shows. But yeah, you're right. Like it is, I think we might be the first generation to do this, that it's like you can't just get into ceramics. You have to go and exhibit your work and have an Etsy site. You can't just make music on the side. You have to have a SoundCloud. It's a peculiar thing. And I think it comes out of wanting to share and that we have been raised to share online. We have to be legitimate in what we do.
I wonder if gardening as well maybe enjoys a degree of separation from this, given that it's so durational. All you can really show, I suppose, you could endlessly post a seedling kind of in a protracted time lapse over days on Instagram, but really you're just showing before and afters.
Yeah.
And I guess it's the maintenance that the processes of watching things grow, of caring for them, of nurture, all of these different sort of quite maybe fundamental instincts that you find peace in.
Exactly. You've hit the nail on the head there. Yet there's nothing to be documented when you're planting seeds. There's nothing. The excitement and the joy that I get when I come out and look at my balcony and something has bloomed or budded or emerged from the soil will never look good in a photograph on the internet, and nor will I be able to, even in a book, like be able to capture properly what that means to me in my life. And I think that is why it retains so... I think that is why it retains such a special meaning. And not just for me, for everyone who gardens. It's interesting in the process of writing and publishing this book, how many people have come and like, this resonated and this is what I get from gardening and I've had a career change. People have been doing this for centuries, like going back to nature.
Right, and that's it. Because, you know, you use as the chapter headings the names of the months. And you speak about this kind of return to seasonality, which one feels quite divorced from in the city, in the kind of urban landscape. But you also make the point that you grew up in the countryside. And I wondered what your sort of reflections are on what each maybe offers the other, because there is a grass is always greener thing, right? People in the city think, I want to go and live in the countryside. Yeah. And people in the countryside feel like completely trapped and can't wait to get to the city.
Yeah. Personally, I'm at an interesting point in my life because a lot of my friends have got to that point where they want to leave London and they have these idyllic homes in tiny countryside cottages. And it seems idyllic, but yeah, I lived in a little village in the countryside until I was 19 and I found it deeply claustrophobic. I maintain now that for all of the delightful childhood that I had, I would never return to the countryside. And that is because the process of the book and the process in which I live was about finding nature in the city. I think people think that they can't coexist. And actually, the stranger thing is much the way that cities have more diversity of people and interests and activities to the countryside. The city also has a greater diversity of plants and nature as well. It's why our honey that we make in the city tastes different from that that's made in the countryside, because there's just more flowers of a different nature in cities. So a lot of it is about actually learning to look. And it's not saying, oh, right, you live in a city, therefore escape and go to the countryside. It's saying we need to hunt it out and cultivate it in the city, because the fact is we live here, our jobs are here, our lives are here. I'm not going to leave London. That doesn't mean I should be deprived of nature.
Do you think that some cities are better at recognising the importance that the natural world kind of plays than others?
Yes, definitely. I mean, I've not done a global span. If anyone, not Monocle, would be better with that, with your city ratings and things. But yes, I mean, the ones that are more located within easy reach of the countryside do reflect that better. But within the UK, London's actually pretty great. I mean, we have 47% green space, which is, I think, the highest, certainly the highest in Europe, possibly in the top five in the world. And we also have a number of garden designers who reflect nature here. So if you went up to Buckingham Palace and you saw the gardens there, they wouldn't be particularly diverse for nature. But we have brilliant garden designers like Dan Pearson, Nigel Dunnett, and a lot of smaller designers besides who are encouraging in wildflower growing and more seasonal planting. We're pretty on the cutting edge of that.
The book is sort of subtitled Rewilding a Life. And that's interesting that you mentioned those garden designers, because there is this idea of the English garden as this Capability Brown inspired, kind of sterile, maybe like Victorian, very carefully husbanded place. Is there a broader cultural shift towards managed wildness?
Yes, increasingly. And I think actually we're at a really interesting moment with increased awareness of the climate catastrophe and with Extinction Rebellion. There is a continued push and a real sense of responsibility on those who garden that we need to do more. Our gardens can't just serve us, nice to look at, but also that they need to serve the wider ecological frame and that that's beneficial as well. I mean, beautifully wild gardens look gorgeous for a reason. So there's a new perennials movement. People like Piet Udolf, who's a Dutch designer, very good with this. He did the High Line and also the Houser and Worth Gardens down in Somerset, among many others. And there are also there's a new tranche of garden publishing as well. There's a book called Wild About Weeds by a designer named Jack Wallington, which is literally encouraging us to leave the weeds in place. If plants are growing in a space, there's usually a reason for it. And we're becoming more responsive to that notion.
You mentioned that the book has sort of resonated with people who find the similar piece to you in this kind of process of growing things. And there, you know, you were talking about garden designers. We're thinking about our relationship generationally with the city, I suppose, this feeling of dissatisfaction that probably, I suspect, millennials aren't the first generation
no,
to feel.
No, I don't think so.
Certainly, we probably also think that we are in that classic way. But I wonder how much all of these things are tied up for you in being the age that you are in the age that you live.
So I'm really glad that you brought up other generations, because the book also looks at young Victorian women who went fern hunting and how the arts and crafts movement in almost exactly 100 years ago rejected the tidal wave of Victorian progression. And before that, people have brought plants with them in times of change, generations, and have definitely felt stifled by the endless increase in speed of the lives we're expected to lead. As for whether it's unique to my generation, I think there are certain quite well-documented phenomena that have put us in a certain hole. You know, we graduated into a recession. There's never been higher competition for jobs. Our housing situation is completely bonkers. Everyone is migrating to a city in greater numbers than ever before. We've got rapid urbanisation. So there are a number of things that stop us from accessing nature. And also an argument that I would make is that of our parents' generation, so our grandparents tended to garden as a hangover from the war effort. And I think our parents were the first to literally like deck over the gardens, put over patios, put car parks out instead of front gardens. Someone said something interesting to me recently that was, she doesn't think that we'll have greenhouses for our children in the future. And so is there going to be that notion of our grandparents' greenhouses just won't exist anymore? So yeah, I do think that we grew up without nature.
Do you think that reflects a kind of shifting focus of priorities, you know, the idea that you might pave a garden instead of growing things in it, which actually seems kind of, you said that and I was like, oh God, that sounds awful. What a that seems like an objectively bad idea, right? But does that kind of reflect, you know, there is this sort of slightly fetishistic treatment of the countryside, this idea that, oh, we'll move to the countryside and it'll be all right. Is that the kind of generational shift? Do we see in the past the city as a centre of prosperity was the kind of aspirational place, so people try to urbanise the countryside, and now perhaps the pendulum's swinging the other way and people are trying to kind of countrify urban spaces?
People are trying to green up urban spaces purely because we need to. The planet is heating up. One of the ways to counter that is to rewild it, and there's increasing consciousness of that. I also think that the idealization of the countryside has been happening for a long time. People did it between the wars. They moved out to the countryside. People did it in the 70s. The good life existed. But I think that other things are happening to our generation living in the city that mean that we're unlikely to pave over our front gardens because we're unlikely to own our houses, and we're unlikely to have a car because there are ride-sharing apps. We are more likely to grow our own food because we're very conscious of where it's being flown in from. It's an interesting swirl of things happening. That's the one thing that brings me hope, actually, possibly naively, but there is a real push to try and renature the cities we live in because we kind of have to.
To go back to the book, you mentioned at the beginning that maybe it had turned out a bit more personal than you had expected it to be, that it was this kind of investigation of nature in the city. But what other questions did you set out to answer when you were writing it?
I suppose the main change that happened with the book over time is that I thought it was going to be about one big life event, which was when a relationship I thought I was in for the long term collapsed. And it ended up being about so much more than that. It ended up looking at our place in society as the people of our age, and it became an examination of wider social and political issues. other questions. I suppose that makes it sound like I wrote with a plan. I suppose I think I was curious to know who'd done it before us and to see the links between the teenagers in the 1850s who went to find ferns and trade them and take photographs of them with the reason that our generation on Instagram will go and climb mountains and take pictures of it. And I found it so fascinating that we are not the first to do this, and also really comforting as well, that this urge is innate in us as humans.
I mean, it's also kind of worrying, isn't it? It's been in the news recently that people are sort of compulsively stealing clippings
yes.
of succulents from Kew
yeah.
Gardens. Your background is, as you mentioned, as a journalist. Journalism is lovely to do. We're very lucky to be working in
yes,
it.
Yes, charmed existence.
It really is. But the writing, you know, the form that it has to take is pretty prescriptive.
Yeah.
Feels like you were having a really good time writing this book.
Yeah, yes, as much fun as one can have writing a book when in between the large times of self-doubt and panic. That was the main reason for the book, and actually the book's origins were in a newsletter I increasingly infrequently send out, but that was very much existed as a sketchbook, a release where I could write fairly formless without having to put the lead at the top, without having to think about a headline and who's going to click on it. After spending 10 years as a digital journalist, it was a real joy just to write something that was completely esoteric. And the fact that a publisher wanted to pick it up, great. But it was primarily because I needed to write that way.
You mentioned that self-doubt there. Did the satisfaction outweigh the struggle enough for you to maybe be thinking about what you might write next?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it. I mean, the funny thing with releasing a book is like any long-term project, you're sort of creatively and mentally done with it many months before it's actually published. So that's been ticking away. I haven't formed upon anything yet. But yeah, I mean, writing books is quite addictive. As I'm sure many authors will tell you, it's horrible and addictive. So fingers crossed there'll be something else brewing up soon.
Thanks to Alice Vincent and her new book, Rootbound, Rewilding a Life, is out now. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly.
Fernando, what is masculinity? That's the theme of the latest Barbican exhibition, looking at men and how their masculinity has been expressed, experienced and coded from the 60s to the present day.
The exhibition brings together works from over 50 artists, some of them women, who depicted masculinity through photography. From Richard Avedon's iconic work about the patriarchy to Herb Ritt's Fred with Tires, the exhibition is a vast look about what it means to be a man.
Interesting. Fernando spoke to the curator of the exhibition, Masculinities, Liberation Through Photography. Here's Ilona Pardo.
The whole point of the show is the fact that we've been looking at representations of the female experience. You know, we've had four waves now of kind of feminism and art made in response to that. We're looking very much at these ideas of identity politics, the politics of representation and so on. And they're always measured against something. And what that thing is measured against is hegemonic, heterosexual, white, cis masculinity, the dominant male. But yet we never put the spotlight on it because it's seen as being something that's static, stable, immutable. It doesn't change. And of course, that is simply not true. It is as performative as any other identity. And it is an identity that absolutely needs to be unpacked and unraveled, not only for the good of itself, if I dare say that as a female, but also in order to have a greater complexity, but also to understand the position of the other. So that's not just women, but also other marginalized masculinities, whether it's the queer body or the black body or the brown body or the physically impaired. These need to be broken down. And so this was an opportunity to scrutinize, investigate, examine not only the construction of that image, but also the counter representation of those images. Let's prize it apart. And artists have been at the vanguard of doing that. And I think particularly photography has been exemplary in kind of positioning and putting forth counter representations.
Very much so. And I love, you know, you talk a lot about queer identity, black bodies, but even for example, the work of Richard Avedon, you know, the family, what a powerful portrait. And it just shows how men were dominant at that time, and it is just incredibly powerful in the way it's situated here in the exhibition.
Yeah, so that section is quite a mischievous section. It's called Male Order, Power, Patriarchy in Space, and it's really reflecting on the construction of male power, but also inviting us within that context to reflect on gender and class. You know, it's really looking at the power dynamics, the inequalities that happen, not only between the genders, so between men and women, but also within the genders, because there is a hierarchy of gender. It's like a ladder, atop which sits the kind of white cis male, and everything else comes in between, and there is a definite hierarchy. And this Male Order section kind of plays with that. It points to it, it unravels it. It's also looking at how male power kind of scaffolds itself, reinforces itself, how it hands itself down, it becomes a form of patronage. What's so great about Avedon's work is, a series of 69 images of 73 portraits of the kind of the great and the good of the time, those who clasp the reins of political, economic and cultural power in their hands. But it shows the confluence of forces. It shows who knows who. There's a system of patronage. We think we live in a meritocracy. We don't. It's very much like going to the Medici family. They all know everyone. It's cronyism and nepotism in a way, but it's also kind of handing power to those who look like us. And I think that's also exemplified in Karen Knorr's very kind of searing series, really, Gentlemen, which is taken a few years after Richard Avedon's work in 81-83, and looking at the performance of the British political establishment in their kind of opulent architectural interiors.
I also love, I think it's the very first kind of selection of photograph, which is those soldiers. But I think the photographer there, he didn't want to use the Western gaze, when he was talking to people that are not actually from the Western world in a way. I thought that was brilliant. And that's another thing that perhaps is not much discussed,
Yeah.
It's not just kind of those National Geographic things. Oh, look, or those interesting people. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. We wanted to absolutely bring in, this idea of the show is titled Masculinities. We wanted to underscore the plurality of kind of identities. And so therefore, it couldn't only have a kind of Western-centric bias to it. We wanted to absolutely kind of break it down, open it up, and invite artists to kind of see how they have imaged themselves, but they always do it very knowingly in response or in relationship to the Western gaze, or at least that's how we read it. And yeah, so the images that you're referring to are by a Lebanese artist called Fouad El Khoury, who's based in Beirut, and he studies architecture here in the UK and goes back to Beirut at the height of the Lebanese civil war and has consistently photographed the civil war and its aftermath in his hometown of Beirut. And what we see is these great photographs of these soldiers, of these what he calls militiamen, kind of performing their masculine. I mean, they're dressed in kafirs and kind of combat boots, combat fatigues and boots and so on. And yet they are performing their masculinity. I mean, what we don't see in the show, in the section that looms large about the military, is, men in the heat of battle. That wasn't of interest. What's of interest is how these kind of soldiers perform it. They kind of exaggerate it. You've got this guy with his arms up. He's playing the part. These are ideas, representations that we've learned. They're symbolic, they're coded ways of being. And we wanted to kind of, unpick that.
And I love the number of work of women depicting men as well, which, again, I'm glad it's here. I love the selection of photographs of those young American football players. I thought it was so playful, amazing photographs.
There are a series by the American artist Catherine Opie, made between 2007 and 2009, titled, as you said, High School Football. And what she did is crisscrossed America photographing high school footballers, so kind of 15 to 18 year old boys who just come off the pitch. They're not staged at all. They're quite complex portraits, and what we see are these kind of very gladiatorial, and they've got the kind of American football, they're kind of armature. It kind of makes them larger than life. But the sports pitch, the sports field has been this amazing arena in which for men to perform their masculinity. We can think of, I use the word gladiatorial quite deliberately. We think of the gladiators back in the Roman times. They were performing this as an arena, and the same for Renica Dijkstra's photographs of the bullfighters. They're performing their masculinity. But it's full of complexity because not only are they showing a kind of certain machismo, but they're also incredibly tender and vulnerable, and again, kind of playing to role models of these ideas.
That was Ilona Pardo, curator of Masculinities, Liberation Through Photography. Faye, you also spoke to one of the artists who was featured in the exhibition, didn't you?
Yes, Olga, I had the pleasure to meet Dutch photographer Hans Eikebon. It's interesting because I knew his work, where basically he chose some tribes in the streets and then, for example, men that wear caps, and then he take pictures of like 20. And I thought that was the work in the exhibition, but not really. Actually, they featured one of his earlier works where he pretended to be a father in four different families. And then he took the picture of him like pretending to be a father, which is such an iconic way of expressing masculinity in a way. So it's quite interesting to speak to him, and he's a lovely chap, and again, Og, if you have time, do go to this exhibition. It's a really, really interesting take. But shall we have a listen to Hans Eikebon?
Let's.
I made a work when I was very young, and I was thinking, I would go the rest of my life. Will it be with a woman and a family? And then I was thinking, probably I can try to make four different family pictures of myself. But generally, it was a work in that time. I was very busy with my own identity, and I did many different projects to find my own identity and to tell something about identity in general.
All I can say, I mean, when you look at the pictures, it's amazing. It's so convincing in a way. People would imagine that you were the father in a way.
That is still the most strange thing for me also, that it are four photographs who can be really true. I'm a very good pretender. I mean, but I think it is something to do with that time. That's the reason we look in that way now to that photographs. In that time that I make the photographs, they were very different, and you can see more that it was not really a family. But now all the strange little details are gone away, and now you see four perfect families.
Have you been in touch with any of them, just out of curiosity?
Yes. One is still a very good friend of mine, and one I see once a year. But no, I have contact, and I invited, because the children, that's so strange, the children on the photograph are now 50. And that's strange. And they have already children from, I believe, 15 or 16. That's also so strange. But I invited one every time to the show. Now it was impossible for her, but normally she was also here.
And Masculinity's Liberation Through Photography is open now at the Barbican Art Gallery in London till the 17th of May 2020. You are with the Monaco Weekly.
Well, what a great show.
Absolutely. What an interesting mix of topics. And, you know, even Alice Vincent, I've met her, you know, through Monaco and Culture. And it's so interesting that, you know, her passion for gardening. In fact, I read some of her columns. It inspired me a little bit as well, Og.
I think it is inspiring. Mm. You know, it's a kind of infectious passion, and it's shared. She's very generous with it. She's active across social media. There are YouTube videos where she gives you tutorials on how to look after plants. She had a gardening column. It's an interesting thing. Do you keep plants?
Well, I do. And to be honest, it is hard because you have to give lots of love to them. And, you know, and the weather here in the UK is very different from home, from Brazil, which actually, if you have a garden in Brazil, it's so easy. You basically don't need to do anything. You let nature do its thing. But I think the UK is quite different. And you need to be a little bit more professional. I'm still learning, Og. What about you?
Well, they say you have to talk to them, Faye. What would you say?
Oh, my dear, no, I don't know. I'll be very kind to them.
Don't be rude to the plants.
No swearing.
And I really am looking forward to going to see Masculinity's Liberation Through Photography. I think that's a fantastically interesting theme for a show.
I think so as well. And I think even, you know, the curator there at the Barbican said it was generally one of the best exhibitions at the gallery. And I have to agree. I've been to quite a few. I think they've done it so well. And again, all aspects of masculinity are in there. So, again, I was very much impressed.
Fantastic. Well, we better wrap it up and say some thank yous. That's all for edition 556 of the Monocle Weekly. I produced today's show, and our studio manager was Maile Evans.
The Monocle Weekly will be back again next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, Fernando.
And from me, Augustin.
Goodbye.